Today's reading comes from Daniel chapter 7, verses 9 to 14. As I looked, thrones were set in place and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow, and the hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you. There we go. I'm just going to steal one of these. So he says, for those of you who don't know me, save me from getting confused. Too many iPads. My name is Brendan. I am husband to Amy, dad to Michaela and Zach. I'm not one of the new assistant priests here in the parish, but figured, you know, as I'm preaching, I'll wear the correct-ish version for clergy. My day job is working with the military. I'm a chaplain to the armed forces in the army, posted to Linton Military Camp, where I provide pastoral care to the men and women of our Defence Force, plus their families, trying to look after them in some dicey places. If it looks like I'm fiddling with technology a little bit, part of it is to make sure I get the PowerPoint sorted, so if we can get that up. I'm not used to preaching with PowerPoint anymore. My normal church service is generally somewhere in the bush, generally with some campaign on, with my communion table being my pack. I've just got everything kind of set up there, so having technology is a bit of a luxury for me. It's also nice not having to pause for helicopters and things like that to go overhead. So we're continuing our series that we've been doing for the last few months of looking at the grand story of the Bible. What is going on here? And the way that it's been characterized is by dividing it up into acts like a Shakespearean play. So I'm going to test your memory for a little bit, and I want to see who knows, and I don't want to hear anything from down the back, you know, from those who are part of the team preaching. I want to test everyone else. What are the different acts of the story? So if we can bring up the next slide. So there we go. We've got five acts. Who can tell me what Act 1 is all about? Creation, yep, there was two parts to it. Creation is the first part. Congratulations, you know what Genesis 1 and 2 is about. What about Genesis 3? What happens in Genesis 3? The fall, yes. So Act 1 is all about God's creation and then humanity's ability to muck it up. Act 2. You don't want to remember what Act 2 is about? This is going to be painful. Sorry? The Exodus, that was part of it, yes? Are you looking through your notes? Yeah, so the covenant's part of that. It's about God forming his relationship with his chosen people. What about Act 3? Your notes won't help you now. Not the exile, not... That's part of God's relationship with his people. Act 3 is where we get God walking into the room, where Jesus comes and dwells among us. What about Act 4? That's the Jesus' death and resurrection is the transition into Act 4. Act 4 is the church. It is us. We are part of that story. That's where we find ourselves in this drama. And what about Act 5? When Jesus comes again, when the new heaven and the new earth comes to bear. So the last couple of weeks we've been having this whistle-stop tour through the Old Testament. Somehow we've managed to cram about 500 years worth of history into about 3 weeks. And over the next 2 weeks, we're probably going to do the same. So all up, over the course of about a month and a half, we're going to cover basically a millennia of Israel's history. Over this time, God has called his people out of slavery in Egypt. He has formed them into a nation. He has led them through the wilderness into the promised land. He has given them the covenant, given them the law, showed them how to live as his people. He has let them try to live as his people, journeyed with them as they've mucked it up, as you know all humans tend to do, given them the judges to restore them to right lifestyles, then given them the kings that he asked for, given them prophets to correct them again, and finally, because they just don't seem to be getting it, he has removed his presence from them, gone out from the temple, created space to allow something new to happen. And that's where we find them today, in the part of the story that I'm preaching on this morning. The Israelites are in exile. They have had the Babylonian Empire come through and take away all their leadership, all their decision makers, all the people that knew what was meant to be happening, and taking them into exile. There was a pretty common Babylonian practice. If you take over a country, you just take all their leadership away, and then you've just got the people that still run everything. They still make the food and build and all that sort of stuff, but they can't organize themselves in the way that they used to be. So it didn't just happen with the Israelites. That was what the Babylonian Empire did. And that's happened to the Israelites, and we're at this point now. To frame what I'm going to say today, I've got a question that I want you to sit with, and we're going to be asking it of the Israelites at this period of time. If you bring up the next slide. Who or what do you put your hope in? So that was a key question for the Israelites to wrestle with as they are in exile. Ultimately, they put their hope in a restored relationship with God. Those that were willing to acknowledge it, acknowledged that they had failed in their side of the deal with God, and hence they had been taken into exile. God hadn't protected them from the invading empires because they were no longer being faithful to God. But like most of us know, you get the Sunday school answer, you get the nice and easy answer. You know, the Israelites hoped for a restored relationship with God. The thing is, you've always got to ask a second question. What does it actually mean? What does that actually look like? Because once you start scratching away at the surface of some of those easy answers, you start to see some very different understandings about what's going on. So what did that mean? What did this hope for the Israelites mean? Well, actually, it meant a return to being an autonomous nation. They wanted to be set free again to be the nation of Israel as they understood it. So they wanted their capital back. They wanted Jerusalem back. They wanted their temple back. They wanted to be able to run their lives the way that they thought that it should be. So for the Israelites, they would say that they put their hope in a restored relationship with God. But what they actually meant by that is they hoped and longed for a restoration of the nation of Israel. They hoped and longed for a restoration of the temple, for the kings, for that which they had previously before they were taken into exile. So it wasn't actually about that restored relationship. It was about going back to the way that things was. So as we look at this, the books that I'm using to examine kind of what's going on here are Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Those books don't really quite naturally go together. Those of you that know the order of the Old Testament know that there's actually, you know, they're in different parts. You've got Ezra and Nehemiah that fit at the end of the Chronicles, telling the story of the leadership of Israel. And then you got Daniel kind of chucked in somewhere else. I've got a confession to make.
I'm pretty young. Well, I like to think I'm pretty young. I don't really get Shakespeare. This idea about like the five-act play and all that grand narrative stuff, like this just doesn't really work for me. Like Shakespeare is something that we talked about at English in high school, and I just switched off. Like I could name a couple of lines from Shakespeare plays if I'm honest. I'm not very cultured. But for me, there's another body of work that I think really captures what's going on for Israel at the moment. It's similar in the amount of content that it has, though some might argue that the quality is slightly different. So this body of work that I'm going to draw kind of the metaphor for where the Israelites are at this part of the story is, if you bring up the next slide, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So for those of you, particularly I'm going to be talking about a couple of things that happen, this is where I get a little bit geeky, in phase three of the cinematic universe. For those of you that aren't familiar with the Infinity War saga, I'm sorry, there are going to be some spoilers, but you need to stop living under a rock. So in one of the movies of the Infinity War saga, Thanos, the mega villain of the story, the protagonist, has finally got all the stones that gives him the power, all the powers that have been seeking and fighting for his life to fix the problem that he saw in the universe by erasing half of all living creatures. He's finally got this power, and Thor, one of the heroes of the story, the god of thunder, he comes in. And at this point, Thanos has already killed his brother Loki, who's got a bit of a love-hate relationship with. He's seen his home be destroyed as part of this Infinity War saga that's going on. And Thanos is caught up in his own grief, in his own emotions, in his own part of the story. And he sees an opportunity to fix it. If you bring up the next slide, there's a famous line that goes with this, if you can make out the image. You should have gone for the head. So Thanos has come in with his axe, and he's struck Thanos and hit him in his chest, trying to kill him, trying to stop Thanos in his tracks. Thanos turns around and says, you should have gone for the head. Because Thanos has the power to create and uncreate the universe. So straight away, he no longer has a wound in his chest and he enacts his plan. Thor tries to fix the problem out of his own strength. He tries to do it himself instead of working on the greater plan that actually needed to happen, that we see happen in the fourth Avengers movie. I'm not going to keep on pulling at the MCU thread. It might start getting a little bit tenuous. But this is it's similar to what's happening for the Israelites at this time. When they're looking at the temple, when they're looking at Jerusalem, they know that they want the restoration of their relationship with God. And they know what that looks like. And so they're doing everything in their power to get there. So we're going to spend a little time sitting with each of these books that I've been talking about. So if we go on to the next slide, the book of Daniel. Daniel's this weird mix of literature in a book. It's a historical book where there's historical accounts from the early days of the exile under the Babylonian Empire. There's some prophetic literature in there where Daniel interprets the ruler's dreams and provides some prophecies about what is going to be happening. There's also a bit of apocryphal stuff, so belief about the end times, which is what we read today. In amongst the story is a story of one Israelite's faithfulness to God, and in a lot of ways he's actually a symbol of what Israel was meant to be, and for us, what we are meant to be like. He is faithful in a really challenging circumstance when everything else has fallen away. He is faithful to his call to be in relationship to God, to be faithful to God. And as a result, there's this repetition of transformation that comes from Daniel's behavior. So Daniel is faithful to God, and as a result, the rulers, the head of the Babylonian and then the Persian empires, see that Daniel worships the one true God, and they make declarations about that. There's this transformation that happens because Daniel is living out the role of Israel, of being a priest to the nations, of being an example to the nations. Then we'll go to the other two books that we're going to talk about actually come about 100 years later or so under the Persian Empire, and that's Ezra and Nehemiah. And that's all about that rebuilding of the temple and rebuilding of Jerusalem. So let's take a moment, though, and look at some more of Daniel's, what was going on with Daniel's visions. Daniel, first of all, interprets the dreams of King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar has this a couple of dreams which are actually about the fall of his empire, saying that another empire will come and it'll be greater than his empire and it'll take over. Daniel shows incredible bravery when he interprets these dreams for King Nebuchadnezzar. He's willing to front up to the person that can have him ordered to be killed in the next moment and say, "Your empire is going to fall." The final empire that comes, or the final kingdom that comes, is expounded in the reading from today as well. It is God's kingdom that ultimately will come and will rule over all. So there's this picture within Daniel that there will be empires and empires and empires, taking over the other, but ultimately God's kingdom will reign over all. So Daniel is kind of showing that overall promise of God, of that his kingdom will come to bear in the end. The question that Daniel never answers, but is posed to the hearers of his prophecies, the hearers of his visions, or his interpretations, and the readers of the book of Daniel, is who? Who is it that is going to restore Israel? Who is it that is going to bring that kingdom to bear? Bring up the next slide. Who would restore Israel? So Israel has always had this history of figures being the key person that leads them into a new period, whether it's Moses, whether it's Abraham, whether it's the prophets or the judges. There is always someone that steps up to the mark, someone that accepts God's call and lives that out in their time and place and leads Israel into a new thing. So Israel naturally would see these prophecies, would believe that they were going to be restored, but would be asking, who is it? And would be the Israelites, when they didn't have someone leading them, would be continually looking for someone to lead them. What's the name that we give this person? The Messiah. Yeah. So that's who we mean by the Messiah, the one who is going to come that would bring God's plan to bear. I've got another question for you. Bring up the next slide. How many messiahs did the Israelites believe that there would be? I see some confused looks. We assume that there would be one messiah. The reading from Daniel 7 from today suggests that there will be one messiah. But actually, I've got a reading from another part of Daniel for you, just one verse. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there before me stood two others, one on this bank of the river and one on the opposite bank. There's repeated visions of multiple messiahs. It's easy for us to assume, given what we know now, that everyone always thought that there would just be one messiah who would be coming, who would be leading the Israelites back to the promise. But actually, they often believed that there were going to be two. They believed that there would be a Davidic messiah and that there would be a Levitic messiah. So someone from the line of David, there would be the king, there would be the conqueror. And someone from the line of Levi who would be their priest, who would be leading them, who would be shaping their worship. And that's what we see in Ezra and Nehemiah. Bring up the next slide. So in these two books that should be read as a pairing, Ezra is rebuilding Israel's worship. He rebuilds the temple, rebuilds the way that Israel worships and interacts with God. Well, Nehemiah focuses on the city. He rebuilds the border, he rebuilds the wall, and recreates the city of God together they pair up and they work together to rebuild Jerusalem and Israel's worship and to be that focal point for the return of the promise. As I said right at the start, the Israelites believed that God would restore their relationship, or hoped that that he would restore their relationship with him. But what they actually hoped for was they wanted their nation back, they wanted their kingdom back, they wanted their city back, the city of David. They wanted their temple back. They didn't want to have to worship in the diaspora. They wanted to be themselves again, regain that which they had lost. So Ezra and Nehemiah, when they're seen together, are an example of what that dual Messiah would look like. There would be two of them that would work in tandem. Things got a bit loose throughout Israel's history with some of this, with believing about Messiahs. We know from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was a collection of scrolls that were found by the Dead Sea, funnily enough, after World War II, that actually there were, at times, just before Jesus was born, they actually ended up believing that there would be three Messiahs. For the life of me, I've never quite figured out what that third Messiah was going to do, but they believed he was going to be there. The Israelites had this firm-held belief that someone or a group of people would come to lead them back to being in relationship with God. And when they saw Israel's temple, when they saw Jerusalem being rebuilt, then they believed that that was going to be the start of that restoration. And all they needed to do was protect that. One of the things in the military, in the army that we do is we like to go into the field, into the bush, and we do pack marches. And we get taught a lot of different skills around how to find your way. Often there isn't a track that you follow. Doc hasn't neatly laid out a kind of path for you to follow somewhere in Wauru. You get a map and you go, yep, I'm going from here to here. So we get taught all these skills for navigation. One of the things we get taught is when you're going uphill, you've got to be aware of false crests. So some of you will know what a false crest is, where you're going uphill and it looks like the hill is about to end. You're busy kind of, you've got a stupid amount of weight on your back and you're kind of walking along and you see the horizon coming to meet you. You see the edge of the hill and you think, I've made it. This is done. I've cracked it. I can stop climbing a hill now. And then you get there. And the hill keeps on going. Your vision is limited because of your perspective. You can't see the entirety of the hill. So we get warned about that because, you know, if you do that multiple times with 40 kgs on your back, you get a little bit sad. And army doesn't like sad, so we train people to expect it. But for this idea of a false crest, of your perspective limiting kind of what your understanding of your story, of your experience, I think that's a really good image for Israel at this time, when they go back to the temple, when they go back to re-entering that promise, leaving the exile, going back to being God's chosen people. Because it's a false crest for them. They think that they've made it. They think they've got that restoration. But we know that that's not the case. There's another 400 plus years between Ezra and Nehemiah and Jesus coming. And we know that they get conquered again. We know that they get taken into, they lose their autonomy again. We know that they don't restore their faithful relationship with God. So they don't even get the end result of what they're after, let alone the underlying, what they were saying that they're after around the restoration of God. It's a false crest because we know that they didn't make it. We know that there's more to come. But also going back to that image from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they're trying to restore that relationship on their own. They're focusing on the end result. They're just trying to get it done. They're not focusing on restoring that relationship. They're just trying to get their kingdom back. There's a real danger for us as well. Yeah, what does that mean for us here and now? You know, there's a danger for us that we do unintentionally what Israel did. That we try and make the end result of God at work in our lives happen without actually being in relationship with God. We try and make the end result of God's promise happen without living in relationship with God. There's a bit of human nature going on. Often we tend to focus on the end result. We don't focus on the journey that gets us there. I think the church today struggles with a lot of this. We know what it's like. We've been through 2 years of a pandemic. We know what it's like to long for what has been. We know what it's like to long for that which we have lost. But a return from exile into promise is not going back to the way that things were. A return from exile into promise is living in relationship with the one who is central to that promise and seeing what that promise means in your new reality. If we go to the final slide. Because this is what it's about. Trusting in God, restoring that relationship with God, and seeing what happens as a result of that relationship. Doesn't mean you're going to get what you used to have. Things may look different. They may sound different. It's about trusting in Him. So we get the worship team back up. Shall we pray? Lord, it's so easy in the changing world to long for that which we feel is lost. Lord, as we look at the story of the Israelites, of their desire to return from exile to relationship with you, Lord, we put on ourselves and we ask ourselves, how are we doing the same thing? How are we seeking after that which we've lost or that which we feel that we've lost instead of seeking after you? Lord, show us those things. Show us those things that have become idols in their own right so that we can lay them at your feet, so that we can offer them up to you, so that we can focus on you, of restoring our relationship with you. Amen.